This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, our How to Be Creative series continues with a look at how ideas get translated into something more.
Right now, we cannot think of anything that dark energy is likely to affect except our poetic vision of the world.
And once you get a good idea, how do you make it a reality?
It's not as though you have an idea and tomorrow you write a paper and you submit it to the journal and it's done.
That's the key thing. There's invention, just for invention's sake, and then there's problem solving, where you invent something to solve real problems.
And I think a lot of the effort is really drudgery.
I'm the kind of inventor that's looking to make whatever amount of time we have in this world better. And so execution has always been part of it.
When a good idea is not good enough, that's coming up on Freakonomics Radio right after this hour's news. Last week, we heard about where creative people get their inspiration.
You know, going to the Met and standing in front of that painting of Joan of Arc, that painting has inspired me.
And how ideas work in a group setting.
Popular opinion often is that brainstorming is just sort of sitting around and saying whatever comes to your mind, but it's not.
The prize-winning novelist Jennifer Egan told us about an unlikely source for her ideas.
What I love about watching baseball is that I get a lot of ideas for fiction while doing it.
People watching at minor league baseball games, museum visits, or putting yourself in strange surroundings, all sorts of ways to generate ideas or let ideas come to you. Or maybe you like to ask the really big questions, like, what is the underlying geometry of the universe? That's what got the astrophysicist Margaret Geller going.
So then the question is, the universe is big and life is short. So how do you address this question if you have a small telescope and you want to get done?
The same sort of question can also work for a poet.
I'm Tracy K. Smith.
Smith is the current poet laureate of the United States. Her father was an optical engineer who worked on the Hubble Space Telescope. Smith's best-known poetry collection is called Life on Mars.
I usually have a particular question in mind. Maybe it isn't like, what is the answer to this thing, but why do we do this to one another? Why is it so hard to really love another person, not just strangers, but the people we love? Why is it so hard to keep loving them sometimes? Why is it so hard to love ourselves? You know, those kinds of questions. You can't get an answer to that, but it can certainly set you in motion. And then the way I often tend to write is to sort of speculate, like, what if? I mean, my book Life on Mars is really just a bunch of hypothetical questions. What if the universe is like this? What if it's like that? I found that kind of pointing those questions back down at Earth can be useful in thinking about, like, the real world, the social or the political world.
I was one of those kids who just always wanted to know how the world worked. You know, see the owner's manual. What, you know, how's this whole operation happen?
That's Saul Perlmutter, who also wanted to ask big questions.
And I guess the places that looked like they were asking those kinds of questions were physics and philosophy. And so at the beginning, I always thought that I might study the two of them until I discovered, of course, that either one of them would take up all your time.
And which did he choose?
I'm a professor of physics, and I study cosmology.
Perlmutter is at the University of California, Berkeley, and the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. In 2011, he won a Nobel Prize for helping to discover, contra the belief of earlier physicists, that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate. One possible explanation for this acceleration? Dark energy, a largely unknown force that may make up 70% of the universe. And this is meaningful to know why.
So this is one of these really weird aspects, I think, of basic science, that almost every time we've learned something really deep about how the world works, it's ended up, you know, not only providing us with a, you know, huge philosophical satisfaction, but somehow it makes us more capable. We seem to be able to do things differently as we learn these odd ways in which the world is actually built and constructed. I mean, a good example of this is Einstein's theory of relativity. It was talking about things like, you know, what happens when clocks travel near the speed of light. I mean, we're never going to get one of our clocks, well, at least as far as we know, we're not going to have any of our clocks near the speed of light. And you know, it seems like these were the most abstract concepts that you could have been working with. And yet, you know, every cell phone in our pocket that uses GPS, all those measurements are being corrected by what we learned from Einstein's theory of relativity because of those explorations. And you know, you could never have guessed it. Right now, we cannot think of anything that dark energy you know, is likely to affect except our poetic vision of the world.
Doesn't, I mean, for especially for someone who started out thinking about studying philosophy, I'm just curious whether that fact alone, that dark energy comprises, you say, roughly 70% of our universe, and we have no idea what it is, isn't that, does that present you with a bit of a, if not an existential dilemma, at least a kind of mind-scrambling question that is it a little unsatisfying to go to bed every night not knowing what it is?
Well,
I mean, it didn't bother me until you told me because I didn't know anything about it. But now I feel like, wait a minute, 70% we really don't know. And you actually know this stuff. So I'm curious whether it weighs on you in some way.
I mean, weirdly enough, I think for me, it's one of the real pleasures of life. The idea that there are huge unknowns for us to explore. A lot of what you do in cosmology is mind-boggling, and you have to enjoy having your mind completely boggled. You know, that just the idea of imagining infinite space is already something that I think we just have a very hard time getting our heads around. And then having an infinite space expand so that, you know, it's not that it's expanding into anything, it's just that there's more distance between everything in that space. And that's bizarre, too. And for some of us, that's just a scary feeling. I have one of my siblings doesn't like to even think about this stuff. It just gives her the willies. Whereas for me, I just find there's a real pleasure in feeling like us puny humans working with the bit of the senses that we have and living in this sort of, you know, happy medium somewhere in between the huge and the really, really microscopically you know, and subatomic tiny, have been able to use our little senses to figure out stuff that's happening on this ridiculously big scale and on this ridiculously tiny scale, and that the two have something to do with each other. I just find that it makes it feel like we're right in the mix, in the thick of things, that we're you know, we're getting to play with the universe.
I'm convinced now. I love your way of looking at it because you're right. There is a kind of potentially a downside of that puniness, but the way you've expressed it, you know, we're punching way above our weight by being able to even ponder what's going on so many dimensions beyond. So that's encouraging. I was encouraged by Saul Perlmutter's ability to somehow blend the incomprehensibly vast and the incomprehensibly tiny into some sort of porridge that feels just right. I was also inspired by something else he talked about, his willingness to have his mind boggled. That's his route to coming up with creative ideas. As we heard today, there are many routes. Asking big questions, sure, but also paying attention to the tiny serendipitous details in your world. Keeping an ear out for the dissenting voice, and sometimes being that voice. Figuring out how the limits that are placed on you might actually free up your creative thinking. All of these are good ideas for generating ideas. There's no formula. But as we noted earlier, the idea is just the beginning.
So I'm at Harvard. Undergrad, like I think it's like, you know, end of my sophomore year, and I'm taking this course called Idea Translation, Affecting Change Through Art and Science.
That's Jessica O. Matthews, and this class was back in 2008.
And I had heard from people that they gave you some money to do some cool stuff, and that unlike most universities, they wouldn't own the cool thing that you did. And I was like, okay, I like doing cool stuff. Like, I like inventing. Let's see what happens.
But we should say you were not an engineer or an engineer wannabe.
I was studying psychology and economics. Like, so I grew up wanting to be an inventor. You know, my father is a businessman. My sister, who had been at Harvard for 2 years before me, she actually was studying film. And but she told my dad, my Nigerian dad, that she was studying economics.
I don't blame her.
So 2 years passes. And she graduates, and they hear, oh, visual and environmental studies. And my dad almost has a heart attack in, like, the graduation stadium. And so I'm sitting there just like, all right, Dad, I'll add economics. So anyway, yeah, so taking this course, and I remembered thinking back to when I was 17, when I was in Nigeria, and I was at my aunt's wedding. And as expected, we lost power. As expected, we brought in a diesel generator. And the fumes were so bad. And my cousins, who were in their 20s at the time, they were just like, don't worry, you'll get used to it. And that's what, like, shook me. I was like, don't worry, I'll get used to it. And so I was like, okay, that's a problem for, you know, the people in my family. That's a problem for people in the world. You have 1.3 billion people around the world who still, to this day, they don't have reliable access to electricity. When the sun goes down, that's often the end of their day. And that's a travesty.
So Matthews, faced with a classroom assignment to invent something that would effect change through art and science, she thought about this problem, and she thought about a creative way to address it.
And I observed my cousins showing passion and showing excitement when they were playing soccer, right? So this is where the psychology comes in. And, you know, the same cousins that were saying, don't worry, get used to it, like, had all these highfalutin delusional ideas about what they could do on the soccer pitch that they just couldn't do. They were not as good as Pelé in any single way, but, like, they would tell you they were. And it's like, this is how you need to be attacking life. You know, I want to invent something, not something that would solve the energy problem, but that would address it in a manner that would inspire people to be part of the movement towards solving it.
The invention she came up with was ingenious. A soccer ball that captures the kinetic energy that builds up as it's being kicked and turns it into enough electrical energy to power a reading light. She called her electric soccer ball the Socket. It won some fans in very high places.
As some of you saw, the Socket, the soccer ball that we were kicking around that generates electricity as it's kicked. I don't want to get too technical, but I thought it was pretty cool.
After the Socket came a jump rope that used the same technology. Matthews finished her undergrad degree and got an MBA, also at Harvard, and she started a company based in Harlem called Uncharted Power. The soccer ball and the jump rope didn't turn out to be durable enough, but Matthews has raised $7 million in venture capital and is pushing her company to work on a larger scale, the electrical grid itself.
Our platform is called MOR. It stands for Motion-Based Off-Grid Renewable Energy. And it's a platform that basically leverages our innovations in energy generation, energy transmission, and energy storage to offer what we like to call convenient energy.
One advantage of convenient energy, theoretically at least, is that it is decentralized and therefore would not require the massive capital investments that power plants traditionally need. How well will Jessica Matthews's idea actually work? It's hard to say, and Matthews wouldn't get into the details of Uncharted Power's technology and implementation. So why am I telling you this story? Because it's a story about the power of a good idea. And I think you'd agree that turning kinetic energy that's fun to generate into electricity is a good idea. But really why I'm telling you this story is to point out that a good idea is worth nothing without great execution. That's where Jessica Matthews stands right now, and she knows it.
I think ideas are great, but in a weird way, it's almost like they're meaningless if they don't actually make a difference in our lives. And so, like, I had to figure out execution, because how can I go to my cousins and be like, oh, I have this cool idea for an energy-generating soccer ball, and then, like, 2 weeks later, and they're like, hey, how's it going? And I'm like, oh, I just have more ideas. They'd be like, what? Shut up. Stop coming here telling us dumb stuff, Jessica. So I had to come back and be like, here's the prototype. What do you think? Everyone's going to be motivated by different things, but I'm the kind of inventor that's looking to make whatever amount of time we have in this world better. And so execution has always been part of it.
So far in this How to Be Creative series, we've looked at what sort of circumstances produce creative people and how schools affect creativity. We've looked at where creative people get their ideas. Coming up after the break, We explore the handoff from idea to execution and why making something and making it work can be so hard.
You can have perfection on a piece of paper and say this is a beautifully designed piece of architecture or a fantastic recipe or a great script. And it's going to really go south when you try to execute it.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, committed to providing tools to enable customers to bundle home and auto insurance. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Walter Isaacson has written biographies of some of the most creative people in history. Leonardo da Vinci, Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, and Steve Jobs.
Who in his first stint at Apple was such a perfectionist that he holds up shipping the original Macintosh because he doesn't think the circuit board inside is pretty enough, even though nobody will ever see it. And after a while, he gets fired from Apple because he's such a perfectionist. And he would say, well, real artists sign their work, meaning they have to wait until they're perfect before they ship. When he comes back to Apple at the end of the 1990s, they give him a new model, which is real artists ship.
But how do you ship your work? How do artists and scientists and inventors and other creative people turn the sparks flying around in their heads into something they can share with the world?
Well, one of the difficult things, of course, is moving projects forward. There's a big difference between the idea and the execution.
That's the pioneering astrophysicist, Margaret Geller.
And sometimes, you know, you start to do something and nature just doesn't conform. And you wonder, why me? After the fact, it's fun, but it's not so much fun while you're doing it. It's often very slow. It takes a long time. A lot of it is drudgery. It's not as though you have an idea and tomorrow you write a paper and you submit it to the journal and it's done. And I think it's the same with art, with writing.
Now, there are exceptions to prove every rule. The writer Michael Lewis, for instance. Among his books are The Big Short, Moneyball, and The Undoing Project. Even when he writes about complicated topics, Lewis's writing is extraordinarily pleasurable and easy to read. So I once asked Lewis, it can't be so pleasurable and easy to write, can it?
Yes, it is pleasurable and easy. I hate to ruin your punchline, but actually what's hard for me is figuring out in the beginning what I want to say. I spend a lot of time gathering material and organizing the material before I sit down to write. I'd say 3/4 of the time is that. When the actual writing starts, it's, for me, fun. It's just fun. I mean, it's fun and hard, but if it's hard, it's hard in a fun way. And people who have, like my wife, who has walked in on me while I'm writing, I write with headphones on that just plays on a loop, the same playlist that I've built for whatever book I'm writing. And I cease to hear anything in the world outside what I'm doing. And apparently, I'm sitting there laughing the whole time. I think basically what I'm doing is laughing at my own jokes. I wasn't even aware of that. But people, my kids and my wife say that you're sitting there at the desk laughing all the time.
Okay, so let's set Michael Lewis aside. He's his own category, the untortured artist. Let's look at a project that was so difficult to execute that its creator did not finish it in his lifetime and which is still being worked on today, nearly a century after his death. If you've ever been to Barcelona, you already know what I'm talking about. The Sagrada Familia Church, designed by Antoni Gaudí, among the world's best-known architects today, who during his lifetime was a troublemaker.
He was someone who was very loath to follow the kind of textbook standard way.
Gijs van Hensbergen is a Dutch art historian who's written a biography of Gaudí. He is also, interestingly, a certified suckling pig specialist.
Yes, I trained to write a cookery book, in fact, and using food as a way of understanding a different culture. So I went to train in Segovia in the center of Spain, just north of Madrid, as a suckling pig chef.
All right, let's get back to Gaudí, the man behind the unfinished masterpiece in Barcelona.
You know, he was someone who was prepared not to just go down the orthodox route of what his teachers were saying. And in fact, once somebody asked him who influenced you most, and he said, well, I probably learnt more from watching my father making boilers than I ever learnt at architectural school.
He was born in 1852 and grew up in a rural area outside of Barcelona.
As a child, he suffered badly from a youthful version of arthritis. And so as a kid, he couldn't always go to school. And his father, who was a boilermaker for making the stills for brandy distilling, would take him out to the workshop out in the country.
He was enthralled by the exotic look of buildings around the world.
It was also, for his generation, the first generation that could actually just look at photographs and see photographs of buildings all over the world. And he spent all his free time in the library just going through magazines and looking at photographs of buildings.
He was also enthralled by nature.
The little details of shells, the way the wind blow, the way that trees grow, the kind of magical kind of Fibonacci sequences that appear in sunflower heads. And all of these things, he was kind of instinctively, but very empirically, kind of noticing and would reappear in his buildings and his building techniques later on.
Gaudí studied architecture formally in Barcelona, but was unimpressed by the orthodoxy of his teachers. It bored him. When he started getting commissions for houses and apartment buildings and parks, he was relentlessly experimental. His traditional elements were exotic. His modern elements, phantasmagorical. Gaudí was also an oddball, a hermit, a celibate, and something of a despot. He'd show up at a building site in the morning and order the contractors to demolish what they'd built the day before so that he could redesign it. Meanwhile, in the rural Catalonia where he'd grown up, there was a massive economic disruption caused by phylloxera, a disease that ruined the grapevines that were the source of many farmers' income.
Once the vines started being attacked and people lost their vines and they lost their livelihoods, came flooding into the cities, and it meant that there was a massive, massive social pressure from a predominantly illiterate working class, which would fill the factories, and massive overcrowding. And the working classes felt that they were being abused, but particularly with the church, they felt that sometimes the church was misusing its so-called charity, looking after them, but actually, in a sense, controlling them.
The Catholic Church was looking to rehabilitate its relationship with these newly urban parishioners. So it decided to build a huge church in a working-class part of Barcelona. It would be dedicated to the Holy Family, the Sagrada Familia, because, after all, Joseph was a carpenter.
The Holy Family could act as a model that the working man, their handicraft or whatever, should be something that is respected.
Gaudí himself was a very conservative Catholic. His feelings for the church and for Jesus ran deep and pure.
Right at the heart of his belief system was this idea that Christ's suffering is something that we understand only through our own suffering, and that his ultimate generosity, of course, was to die for us.
When Gaudí received the commission to build the Sagrada Familia after the original architect resigned from the project, he was only in his early 30s.
And I think Gaudí felt his duty as an architect, and certainly with the Sagrada Familia, was that a building should reflect the glory of God, and that God was working through him.
Gaudí's concept for the church was massive, extraordinarily detailed, a mashup of every architectural style under the sun, but like nothing anyone had ever seen. It included lifelike sculptures of Bible stories, emphasis on the lifelike.
So when on the Sagrada Familia you have the flight to Egypt, He wanted a donkey. It had to be life size. He sends one of his workmen over to look around for a donkey that might look as if it had walked 40 days through the desert. And he finds the rag and bone man's donkey. And he gets it, puts it in a harness, chloroforms the donkey, and then puts it into plaster and makes molds. He does it with chicken, with geese.
This next part Van Hensbergen is about to describe is pretty graphic, so you may want to turn the volume down for about 30 seconds, especially if you're listening with kids.
One of the most dramatic moments is actually the slaughter of the innocents, where the little babies being cast down by this giant Roman centurion, total kind of brutal scene. This baby would have his head smashed on the ground. And Gaudi actually took stillborn children, cast them, and used those models for the sculptures that would then be on the face of his building.
The scale, both exterior and interior, was way larger than life, designed to inspire awe. The interior pillars resemble a forest of grand trees.
Trees are actually some of the most efficient pieces of architecture ever grown, not built, and the way that they can put up with wind and the way that they know where they should stick out a new branch. And he creates this lapidary forest, this extraordinary forest of columns as you walk in, and this soaring space, which is so dramatic, and with these stained glass windows and this amazing light. I mean, even if you weren't religious, there is a very, very powerful kind of explosion of space.
Gaudí would work on the project for the rest of his life, eventually moving into the basement workshop.
Later on in life, he became very ascetic. He you know, kind of made his own clothes. He looked more and more kind of like a tramp. He lived the whole purpose of the Sagrada Familia, which was to create this new Christian temple on a scale which today is kind of only just we're beginning to see what an extraordinary kind of fantasy and dream that Gaudi had created for this building.
I'm also curious because of what Gaudi said about creativity. As you write, creation works ceaselessly through man, but man does not create, he discovers. Those who seek out the laws of nature as support for their new work collaborate with the creator. Those who copy are not collaborators. For this reason, originality consists in returning to the origin. So to me, that is a bit of a paradox, and I wonder if you can explain that for me as it relates to Gaudi, and especially, I guess, as it relates to the Sagrada Familia.
Well, I often think back on Isaac Newton saying, look, I was just like a little boy walking along the beach, picking up a pebble, and I noticed one was shinier than the other. And there is a sense of humility about Gaudi's genius as well, and this idea of going back to the origin, because one of his signature discoveries and something which became right at the core of his building technique was the discovery of the power of the catenary arch. And the catenary arch is take a chain, hold it between your fingers, and let it drop. It's gravity pulling it down, which of course for Gaudi becomes another kind of religious metaphor, because who is it that invents gravity? Well, God, of course. But what you get is this chain formation. If you flip it over, it forms this catenary arch, which is the most economical shape in architecture. And he uses that as a kind of leitmotif for the last 20, 30 years of his creative life, and works on a model which is 4.5 meters high, and all these little chains with little bags, shotgun pellets, representing the different stresses, etc. And almost like an analog computer, sitting there over 10 years out in the countryside, people must have thought, who is this madman? And creating a system which is still used today by the architects who are working on the Sagrada Familia to try and finish it for 2026.
. 2026 will be the 100-year anniversary of Gaudi's death. He died at age 73 after getting hit by a streetcar. As the story goes, his ragged clothes led passersby to think he was a tramp, not the city's most famous architect. In any case, a team of architects is continuing Gaudí's work on the Sagrada Familia. By necessity, they are amending his original plans. To some, this is a betrayal of Gaudí's original genius. Gijs van Hensbergen is not one of those people. He thinks it's in line with what Gaudí himself would have done.
Well, clearly we can't go back to just what was built by Gaudí. Gaudí knew equally that future generations would have to work on it. And you know, he talked about Chartres and other cathedrals, saying that, you know, God took 400 years to finish Chartres. It took 600 years to finish Barcelona Cathedral in the Gothic Quarter. And he said that God is very patient. As a client, he doesn't want to be hurried.
Gaudí was constantly tinkering with his design, sometimes changing them from day to day. Execution by tinkering. Turns out, this is a common thread among many creatives.
Leonardo da Vinci worked on the Mona Lisa for more than 15 years.
Walter Isaacson again.
During that period, he was dissecting the human face, figuring out every nerve and muscle that touches the lips, figuring out how details of sight go right into the center of retina, but what you see out of the corner of your eye are shadows and colors. So he uses all of that knowledge, for example, to make the details on the Mona Lisa smile go straight, but the shadows and colors go up, so the smile flickers on and off depending on how you're looking at it. He also has it so perfectly anatomically correct that it's the most amazing and memorable smile ever created. All of these things he does over the course of this very long period as he's living in Milan and then in Rome and then in Florence and then taking it across the Alps with him when he goes to Paris, he adds layer after layer of tiny translucent brushstrokes until he can make what is probably the most perfect painting ever done.
The most perfect painting ever done? It's pretty hard to quantify. There are people, however, who spent a great deal of time trying to quantify different trends in painting over the centuries, different styles of execution, and their relative value.
I am David Gallinson. I am a professor of economics at the University of Chicago.
And you would describe your research specialty as what?
I study creativity, and really more specifically, the life cycles of human creativity. What I've tried to do is find the process. You know, what are the mechanisms behind the discoveries?
Most great painters throughout history are considered innovators, at least on some dimension. But Gallinson separates these innovators into two camps, what he calls experimentalists and conceptualists. Da Vinci and Gaudí would fit into the experimentalist category.
These are empiricists. They're interested in perception, observation, generalization about the real world. They have very vague but very ambitious goals. And because they're vague, they're uncertain how to achieve them. So they work by trial and error. And these are the people who never reach their goal. They're never satisfied.
Another example would be Paul Cézanne.
Very near the end of his life, he wrote to a younger artist, he said, "The progress needed is endless." And that's experimental creativity. You never can reach the goal.
Cézanne wanted to fuse the realism of the old master paintings he loved with the immediacy of a new style, Impressionism.
Impressionism was, as the name implies, it was an ephemeral, momentary art. So Cézanne was frustrated with Impressionism, with the superficiality. There's no depth in Impressionist paintings. These are all just on the surface. He set out to combine the bright colors of Impressionism with the solidity of the old masters. So Cézanne set out to do something that was essentially impossible. But he spent then the next 40 years trying to do it.
For instance, in his later years, he kept painting the view of a mountain near his home, Mont Saint-Victoire.
If you just take all the textbooks of art history that you can find, there's no single painting by Cézanne that appears more than a few times. But he painted Mont Saint-Victoire about 50 times over a period of about 30 years. If those were all a single painting, all of those illustrations were of a single painting, that would be the single most reproduced painting in the history of modern art. Now, they're all different. He's never doing the same thing. He's always changing, but he's changing so gradually that a lot of people don't perceive it at the time.
So the experimentalist, as Galanzin sees it, innovates by tweaking and tinkering, by methodically moving the needle an inch at a time. Meanwhile, the conceptualists?
As the name implies, these are people who have new ideas. These are theorists.
Galanzin's favorite example? Pablo Picasso. Picasso's process of creation, as described by David Galanzin?
Basically, the process is you come to a new discipline, you learn the rules, and you say, I don't like some very basic rule, and I get rid of it.
Picasso's rule-breaking masterpiece? Les Demoiselles d'Avignon.
Now, that's a painting that Pablo Picasso made when he was 26 years old. And it wasn't just sort of casually done. When Picasso was about 25, you know, he's a young, sort of struggling painter in Paris. And the King of the Hill was about 10 years older, Henri Matisse. Matisse had made a large figure painting called The Joy of Life that made a tremendous splash at the annual Salon. And Picasso was very jealous. So here's this young 25-year-old who starts making preparatory drawings. In total, he makes between 400 and 500 preparatory drawings for this, the largest painting he's ever attempted by far. That's the most preparatory works that have ever been made in Western history for a single painting, as far as we know. Here's a 25-year-old who's not really thriving economically, but he takes essentially a full year to prepare to make this one painting. So he's deliberately creating a masterpiece. That painting is in 95% of all textbooks of art that cover the early 20th century. No other painting is in more than half.
Now, let me ask you this. The way you just described that process, however, doesn't sound so different from the way you described the process of the experimental innovators. Over and over, repeating.
The difference is the following. If you X-ray a Cézanne, you'll find there's nothing underneath the paint. He painted what the artists say directly. He just began using a brush on canvas. He made no preparatory drawings for his paintings, ever. The whole point, actually, was to be spontaneous. That was the point of Impressionism. Whereas, if you X-ray the Demoiselle, you'll find very precise underdrawing. And it's not an accident. I mean, if you go to the Picasso Museum, where they have these dozens and dozens of sketchbooks, you'll find that every figure in that painting was planned extremely carefully. So that by the time he began painting the painting, he knew what it was going to look like. See, this was the first thing I discovered about the difference between experimental and conceptual artists, that it's not just that they paint differently, but they want to paint differently. The conceptual artist wants to know before he picks up a brush, he wants to know exactly what the painting's going to look like, whereas the experimental painter goes out of his way to avoid that. They want to make discoveries in the process of painting. So it comes out of this fundamental question. Do you make the discovery before you start working or while you're working? And in discipline after discipline, that is going to be the key question separating the two types of innovator.
Experimental innovators, Galanzin has written, work by trial and error and arrive at their major contributions gradually, late in life. In contrast, conceptual innovators make sudden breakthroughs by formulating new ideas, usually at an early age. Picasso invented cubism in his 20s. Bob Dylan wrote Like a Rolling Stone when he was 24.
You can get an idea at any age, but the most radical ideas come not necessarily when you're young chronologically, although you tend to be, but when you're new to a discipline.
Experimental innovators, meanwhile, build up to their masterpieces. Virginia Woolf was 44 when she wrote To the Lighthouse. Cézanne was still painting Mont Saint-Victoire when he died at 67. The novelist Jennifer Egan is now in her mid-50s.
Oh my gosh.
By the time Egan won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award for her book, A Visit from the Goon Squad, she'd been writing for a couple decades. She'd only completed 3 novels during that time, and the one that followed, Manhattan Beach, took another 7 years. One reason it takes so long? Her process. The way she executes the idea.
Once I write that first draft, which in the case of Manhattan Beach was 1,400 pages, and type it up, I do many, many, many revisions, usually by hand on hard copies, but we're talking ultimately 40 to 50 drafts per chapter. So there's a lot of fixing and problem solving. And in certain ways, that's where a lot of the writing happens, that it's the big moves that I'm trying to get a hold of in that first draft. And then once I have those, then I can sort of work with it and try to, you know, bring it all up many, many notches to be something that's actually readable and entertaining. Like, my first drafts are full of cliches. I loathe cliches. It's not that you can't write them in the first place. They have to be replaced. So ultimately, I have weighed every word, to use a cliche.
Okay, so if your style of execution is to produce draft after draft after draft, or sketch after sketch, or prototype after prototype, how do you judge what's working and what's not? Every domain is different, of course. Writing a novel is different from building a better means to capture kinetic energy. But in every case, how do you measure the success of your execution? When Jennifer Egan was writing her first novel, The Invisible Circus, she did not have a reliable way to do that.
I wrote in a vacuum, and that was just wildly unsuccessful. I spent 2 years writing horrible, just a dreadful, I mean, and this isn't even being over harsh. So I'm never going to make that mistake again.
Ever since then, Egan has relied on a writer's group, even today, after all the success and all the awards.
It includes a couple of the people I've been showing work to since 1989. We have an essayist, a playwright, a poet, and then a couple of fiction writers.
What the writers group provides, Egan, is something that every creator needs constantly, whether you're working in the arts, and science, and business, whatever. Feedback. Coming up after the break.
I think the biggest danger of being successful creatively is that people don't tell you what they really think anymore. I mean, if that happens to me, I am lost.
And a creative endeavor where everyone is forced to respond to feedback all the time, even when it is terrible advice.
Kids started wiggling in their seats and mom started running out for a bathroom break. So it got cut from the movie.
It's coming up right after this. And if you want to hear all the episodes from this series, you can find them on Freakonomics.com, How to Be Creative series. Also, our entire archive is on the Stitcher app, and Apple Podcasts works great too. Talk to you in a minute.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And by Avery Books, publishers of Atomic Habits by James Clear, practical tips to help increase one's productivity every day. More information at atomichabits.com.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
It's not that great ideas are easy, but without good execution, an idea doesn't mean much. A key component to execution, a key component to getting better at anything, is feedback. The writer Jennifer Egan was telling us that she still relies on a writer's group to workshop her current novel in progress.
Even with Manhattan Beach.
That's her latest book, an historical novel published in 2017.
I had an idea about a sort of present-day narrator who would be kind of winking at the reader because we all know that it's not 1934 anymore. That was so dead on arrival.
And when you get that kind of feedback and you decide ultimately that it's fruitful and that it's correct, what does that feel like?
It feels like a relief. Because usually I can feel when something is not working. Sometimes things aren't working because I just haven't spent enough time making them better.
Did you have to beat up your writing group a little bit after you started winning these awards and say, listen, I still need you to come at me as hard as you did?
No, they did it. No. I would recommend that anyone do this. People are afraid of hearing criticism. And so I think often when they say, what did you think of something? you know that they don't really want to know if you have any thought that isn't positive. And I so understand that. I mean, it's awful to hear that something you think is working isn't. And I have sat there and many times thought, I'm done. I'm never coming back here. It's been great. You guys suck. You don't get it. Other people tell me I'm great. But, you know, even by the end of the meeting, I can feel my brain kind of prickling around whatever it is, and I'm already starting to think of solutions. Mm. So it hurts, but it's not going to kill you. I feel like criticism that's wrong-headed, okay, it's just I don't agree with it. Fine, keep going. Like, there's a fear that somehow criticism can break you. I don't believe it.
Do you have any advice for people who have that fear, which I would guess is probably 95% of humanity?
I would say think very carefully about which is worse, finding out now that this work has problems or finding out after everyone's told you it's perfect and you've published it. You're going to find out.
I think the best thing we could do is to find one honest person who you know will give you honest feedback.
Teresa Amabile is a psychologist who studies creativity.
Ideally, you'll have an artist friend, or maybe it's a teacher, who knows you reasonably well, whom you trust, to whom you can say, I really want some feedback on this, but I need you to not dampen my spark here, if you would. I think that's much better than trying to get feedback from a large number of individuals, one or two people who will be honest with you, but who can give you the feedback in a way that you'll be able to use it and not be destroyed by it. We can manage our feedback givers.
But what if you aren't in a position to manage your feedback givers? What if your feedback givers are your employer or your funder or your customer?
We test screen everything we do. We bring in a living room full of people and show them the movie and then sit around afterwards and have a really painful discussion about things they didn't understand or story points that they didn't like or characters they didn't like.
That's Don Hahn.
And I'm a filmmaker, and I've made most of my career producing animation for Disney, but now do a lot of documentary work.
Among the films he has worked on, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Beauty and the Beast, both the animated and live versions.
And The Lion King, a little story about a lion cub that gets framed for murder.
Hollywood calculus, as we all know, can be strange. A team of filmmakers can work on something for a couple of years and then have it quashed by a room full of little kids who get squirmy at a test screening.
And then you have to go away and decide whether they're right or not. And you can also dismiss it to your peril or dismiss it to your advantage. You know, gosh, and there's endless stories about that. In Pocahontas, the animated movie, there was a love song that Mel Gibson, as John Smith, sang to Pocahontas. And he was tied up in a tent, and Pocahontas came in, and they sang this beautiful love song under the moon. You know, it's like a lovely song. But the audience just checked out and started, you know, kids started wiggling in their seats, and mom started running out for a bathroom break. So it got cut from the movie. But conversely, there's a song in Little Mermaid called Part of Your World, and it's Ariel's I Want song.
Up where they walk, up where they run, up where they stay all day in the sun, wandering free. Wish I could be part of that world.
And that was a real kind of wiggler song where in previews, even though it happens early in the movie, and even though it's crucial to Ariel's character, our executive at the studio said, you know, kids are wiggling during this. We have to cut it out. It's not working. And he was wrong. The directors and the animators came back and said, you know, kids may wiggle during it, but it's the kind of song you need in these movies. It's a statement of what she wants. It's a statement of her goals and passions. And without it, it's ambiguous what she wants. So it stayed in the movie and became, you know, one of the most favorite songs in the movie.
You can see why producers and studios might be cautious. A big film is a huge investment. The desire for feedback has deep roots in Hollywood, including Walt Disney himself.
Walt Disney used to famously walk around the studio, and he would tell the story of, let's say, Pinocchio to a couple guys in the coffee lounge. And then he'd get their reaction, and then he'd go down the road to a couple of secretaries and tell them the story. And so he was workshopping again and again and again this story, and every time refining it in his mind a little bit more until it became very close to what was in the film.
A documentary film, meanwhile, which is what Don Hahn is mostly making these days.
Documentaries are a little different because you're telling an existing story, but you have to go where the story takes you. And when you start out, you may not know all the ins and outs of the plot. So it's a little like putting a jigsaw puzzle together without the picture on the box. You're kind of feeling your way through the dark. And a lot of times there's discoveries halfway through the making of the movie. Like we did a movie for Disney Nature called Chimpanzee about a mother and her little baby chimp. And halfway through the shooting, the mother went out one night and was killed by a panther. So you just go, okay, I guess we're done, you know. But over the ensuing weeks, the alpha male in that tribe of chimpanzees adopted that little baby. Otherwise, it would have died. And that's something that just never happens. Jane Goodall even said she didn't ever see that in the wild. So sometimes you have to just open up enough to go kind of ride the horse in the direction that it's going to have the movie tell you what it wants.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week to wrap up our creativity series. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or on the Stitcher app. You can always get the most recent episodes or subscribe on any podcast app, including Apple Podcasts. As always, thanks for listening.